The constant political chaos can be a lot. You gotta mix it up with a little regular chaos. Go behind the pods with Terminally Online, Cricket's loosest show, where the news takes a backseat to the unscripted antics of your favorite Pod Save America and Cricket Media hosts and staffers. Here, love it, learning about dating apps.
I was single in my 20s, and then yada, 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 I was single in my 40s.
Listen to my sage advice on being kind to retail workers. Just smile, walk away. You don't have a right to be an asshole. And enjoy Tommy celebrating the unrelenting wheel of time.
Time comes for all of us. You will all be out of touch with the culture. You'll all be asking someone what some equivalent of a Yassified means.
Terminally Online is a subscriber-exclusive show. To get access, subscribe to our Friends of the Pod community at cricket.com/friends.
Welcome to Pod Save the World. I'm Tommy Vitor.
I'm Ben Rhodes.
Ben, I did a cable TV hit the other day. Chris Hayes, MSNBC.
Welcome to my world, Tommy.
It was fun. I really like Chris. I like his show a lot. Yeah. He's very smart and they cover foreign policy. But he reminded me how in the before times, before Trump, when there was a crisis in the world and a presidential campaign was happening, advisors to the campaign would do conference calls and put out policy
papers.
The
advisors were like policy people and not like MAGA lunatics.
Dennis McDonough was a campaign advisor, became White House chief of staff. Susan Rice was the campaign advisor, became the national security advisor. And then with the Trump team, they just no comment on everything in the world.
Well, you know, nice work. If
it was a nice trip down memory lane of us in the 2008 campaign having to react to Putin invading the country of Georgia.
Yeah, I remember that. Everybody forgets that they invaded Georgia in 2008, but and Bush did nothing, actually.
Bush did nothing. Literally and McCain nothing. Was like, why are we not there for Saakashvili?
And then Chris was, a Nation reporter. Mm-hmm.
Is it The Nation? Yeah.
Yeah. That was a long time ago.
Long time
ago. Children, young people.
The before times. It was a better time, though, when candidates had to,
simpler time.
Say what they would do and how they would leave the world. Seems like a better idea. Anyway, we're going to do exactly that today. We're going to cover the U.S. airstrikes on militia groups supported by Iran, the latest from Gaza, and the dramatic shift against the Israeli war effort in the United States. We're also going to talk about the fate of Biden's foreign policy agenda and how it's tied up in the U.S. Senate and with immigration reform. We will also cover some a big shakeup in the Ukrainian government. Tucker Carlson took a little sojourn to Russia. Good for him. Hope he's trying some.
Yeah, it's a good weather this time.
Caviar or something. I don't know. What do you do over there? We're also going to talk about elections, the future of democracy in El Salvador, Europe, Pakistan, and Senegal, and then a little on Northern Ireland and some sad news about King Charles. And finally, a little segment called British Conservatives Are Weird.
Well, that's been kind of a standing segment on the show, but we can brand it now.
That's true. That's very true. This is non-Boris Johnson. And then you're going to hear my interview with Politico's Alex Ward about his new book, The Internationalists, which covers President Biden's foreign policy over the first 2 years of his administration. So stick around for that. First Biden book.
Year three is quite the sequel.
It's a big shakeup. What's it? There's that part of a screenplay. It's like the dark period. I forget what it's called.
Yeah.
Dark Night of the Soul, something like that. It's in Save the Cat. Yeah. Read the fucking book. But Ben, should we talk about Iran?
We should.
All right. So, as expected, on February 2nd, last Friday, the U.S. bombed 7 facilities in Iraq and Syria that are used by Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and militant groups supported by Iran. These airstrikes were in response to a drone attack on a U.S. base in Jordan in late January that killed 3 U.S. service members and wounded 30 more. The drone strike in Jordan was one of more than 160 attacks since mid-October on U.S. troops in Iraq and Syria by these militant groups with links to Iran. Here's a clip of Jake Sullivan, Biden's national security advisor, talking about those strikes on Face the Nation over the weekend.
What happened on Friday was the beginning, not the end of our response, and that there will be more steps, some seen, some perhaps unseen, all in an effort to send a very clear message that when American forces are attacked, when Americans are killed, as 3 service members tragically were at Tower 22, we will respond, and we will respond forcefully, and we will respond in a sustained way. I would not describe it as some open-ended military campaign. We have a concept of how we intend to respond. I'm not going to telegraph it on this show, but we will execute that concept with the kind of professionalism that only the U.S. military can bring to bear.
So I guess based on that, we should expect maybe some further airstrikes or like cyber operations or sanctions to come. I don't know. It will take some time to see if this initial set of strikes were successful and these groups were deterred. CNN reported that one main Iran-linked militia group, Kataib Hezbollah, or KH, announced the suspension of its military operations against U.S. troops in Iraq in order to prevent the embarrassment of the Iraqi government. That was their rationale. We'll see if that holds. But on Sunday, there was a drone attack on a base housing U.S. forces in Syria that killed six Kurdish fighters, and the Houthi rebels in Yemen just continue to fire missiles at ships in the Red Sea all day, every day. So, Ben, I was relieved to hear that Biden didn't consider attacks in Iran proper and went with this more limited option, but also a little troubling or worrisome to hear Jake Sullivan say there's no back-channel conversations happening between the U.S. and Iran about de-escalation, although maybe there's indirect conversations through Oman or something happening, or he just didn't want to comment. But what did you make of what Biden chose in terms of this response?
I think in terms of what they chose, it's pretty clear that they were looking, and we joked, I mean, not that any of this is funny, but we made reference last week to when you get three options and you choose the middle option. Yeah. And this is the middle option in the sense that if option one was kind of not having a military response that is escalatory, and then option three was, you know, striking IRGC targets, Iranian Revolutionary Guard targets inside of Iran, they chose an option where they went after these proxy groups and will probably continue to go after these groups in Iraq and Syria and Yemen. And so that's these militias that have been active for a long time in Iraq and Syria and the Houthis in Yemen, but not going into Iran. And the perhaps unseen comment that Jake said seems to be a reference to cyber, offensive cyber, which we don't talk about, the U.S. government doesn't talk about, but I assume that means there might be some offensive cyber operations against the Iranian.
We're going to sign the Iranians up for like a DCCC distro list.
Maybe like one of those kind of strange text messages.
Yeah, from Hakeem Jeffries or something. No bad ideas in a brainstorm.
So that's what they're doing. And I'd expect, you know, a few more airstrikes on that network of, you know, what is called the axis of resistance, these Iranian-backed groups. We talked last week about the fact that Iran doesn't necessarily pick targets or control these groups. Mm-hmm. In terms of deterrence, you made this point about the Houthis already attacking shipping in the Red Sea even after these strikes and some attacks on Syria. What I'd say about this is these groups have been operating in war zones for many, many years, right?
Yep.
You know, the groups in Iraq goes all the way back to the height of the Iraq war.
And mostly just want us out of Iraq.
Yeah. The groups in Syria withstood the decade-long Syrian civil war. So they're not going to be deterred. They're not going to go out of business. They're not going to say, you know, we give up. You might degrade their capabilities. You might have them shift tactics. But fundamentally, the challenge here is there's not going to be some clear moment in which we can announce the restoration of deterrence, because that's not how these groups work. Their ethos is to be in confrontation with the United States, in confrontation with Israel, with the dial turned up because of what's happening in Gaza. They're going to continue to do that, but maybe you make it a little harder for them to do that by doing these strikes. But I don't think you're going to solve the fundamental issue, which is there's an escalation in Gaza and these groups are participating in that escalation. I think that the KH, the Kataib Hezbollah announcement, is about wanting to make the U.S. the bad guy in terms of Iraqi sovereignty.
Yeah,
because
I think they did it before we responded.
They did before.
And
I think what they're trying to do is they want the Iraqi government to feel embarrassed by the U.S. violating their sovereignty by taking airstrikes in Iraq and say, see, like, we're not trying to escalate here. Because what they ultimately want is the Iraqi government to ask the U.S. to leave. And there was about 2,500 U.S. troops there. And there was a bit of a dust up. You and I were texting about this, Tommy. Like, the U.S. government didn't apparently pre-notify the Iraqi government of these strikes.
Yes, right.
And that's the dynamic that KH is trying to play into. So I don't know. I continue to feel like we are on a ladder of escalation. I'm glad that they put some limits on that in terms of not going into Iran. But I also, it continues to just be the case that unless and until there's a ceasefire in Gaza, I don't know how you have a true restoration of some degree of calm in the region.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I think, to your point, Jake's language sort of shift from one about deterrence to just degrading the capabilities of these militia groups, because you're right, you can like blow up some of their missiles, but they're going to get more. The Washington Post reported that The drone that killed the U.S. service members in Jordan went undetected because it flew at low altitude and there were no air defense systems on the site capable of shooting it down. That is different from the initial reports that we talked about last week, that maybe this enemy drone came in as a U.S. drone was landing, confused everybody, and was able to hit the target. But I guess this base didn't have weapons that could kill the drone. They just have electronic warfare defenses to sort of, you know, fry their electronics and take them out. So that's bad. And that's insane to me that, you know, you have a forward deployed base like this and not have sufficient air defenses. But to this broader point, Ben, of whether, you know, the ways this conflict is spilling out into the region, here's another clip from Jake Sullivan. He was on CNN's State of the Union, did a round of Sunday shows this weekend. The question was from Dana Bash. She basically said, you say you want to avoid a broader regional war, but aren't we already in one? We're hitting targets in all these different countries, et cetera, et cetera. Here's a clip.
These are distinct but related challenges. For example, what's happening in the Red Sea is obviously to a certain extent triggered by what's happening in Gaza, but it's not the same thing. The Houthis aren't just hitting ships related to Israel. They're hitting a lot of different ships from a lot of different countries. And so we are trying to deal with the challenge to freedom of navigation in the Red Sea. That is a distinct challenge. The forces in the militia groups in Iraq and Syria are hitting our forces. We're responding. And then, of course, Israel is dealing both with the challenge of Hamas in Gaza and the threat from Hezbollah in the north. So we will continue to work to deal with the challenge of escalation and continue to work to ensure we're responding forcefully, but at the same time, staying out of the prospect of the United States getting pulled into a broad war in the Middle East of the kind that we have seen in the past.
So, Ben, as Ali Baia said to me last week, a ceasefire won't guarantee that Iranian-linked militia groups stop these attacks, but not brokering a ceasefire almost certainly guarantees that they continue. It is a little worrisome that the core point that I think most people seem to agree on, that Gaza is the driver of this uptick in violence, is not echoed by top administration officials.
Yeah, because it's not a matter of opinion. It's just a matter of fact that since October 7th and then the Israeli military response, we have seen the Houthi attacks on shipping in the Red Sea and an uptick in these attacks on the U.S. forces. That's just the reality.
It's like Pentagon data.
That's just what happened. Yeah. I mean, people, so, you know, we've seen violence, acts of violence in Gaza and the West Bank, in Israel, in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, all go up since October 7th. And so by definition, this is connected and this is part of a regional war. And the hottest part of that war is in Gaza. And the scale of the Israeli military operation has been followed by a uptick in the scale of action by these groups. That's just what's happening. And so to be an option one person, you know, people, sometimes people, you know, I did a cable appearance, Tommy, to continue that theme, where someone said, you know, well, isn't it the case that we have to, you know, do we have to respond militarily to what happened at Tower 22? And we don't. I mean, there's not some mandate, you know, that we have to bomb things. The reality is, I believe, ultimately, the thing that will best secure U.S. forces in the region, if that's the objective, is number one, to have a ceasefire and a de-escalation of tensions across the region. And number two, by the way, to not have U.S. forces in some of these places. I mean, as we talked about last week, I don't think that the threat of ISIS necessitates necessarily a certain number of troops in Syria, you know, where people are vulnerable. They're vulnerable to these drones. And so I just think it's important to at least make sure that we're surfacing the reality that it is an option available to the U.S. government to say, we're going to try to double down on a diplomatic approach here. And we're also going to think about whether there's a vulnerability. Because if the idea is that, you know, the one thing that we're going to do to protect U.S. forces that are in all these disparate places in the Middle East is to essentially have more U.S. forces in the Middle East, you know, that's the definition of kind of getting drawn into something. And again, I think you have to be able to articulate, where does this all end? I think that the Biden administration themselves would say that they would like this to end in de-escalation and in some process that could lead to a Palestinian state. And ultimately, there's going to have to be some diplomatic channel to the Iranians. But but how do you get there? And right now we're all about the escalation, and yes, we can talk about, there's obviously these efforts, Tony Blinken's in the region, and we're trying to get a ceasefire or at least a pause for the release of some hostages and the delivery of some aid. But otherwise, it's kind of this tense risk of things continuing to escalate.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's just worth pointing out that in 1983, when a suicide bomber hit an American military barracks in Beirut, Reagan's response was to pull U.S. troops out.
Reagan's response is, you know what? Actually, I don't think these troops should be there. Which is a pretty logical response.
And today you'd be called, you know, like cut and run, coward, whatever nonsense.
But, and that's the other thing is that I think we talked about this last week, but it bears repeating that the politics of this are, there's this sense that the only politics you should be afraid of are being called weak by, you know, Lindsey Graham.
Neocon hawks, yeah.
And, you know, or having a bad day on cable news because, or having even like an Obama red line kind of thing. When I actually don't, the bad politics are U.S. troops being vulnerable. Bad politics are 27,000 people being dead in Gaza. Their outcomes are ultimately going to drive the politics of this stuff.
So let's turn to Gaza. The United Nations World Health Organization says that 100,000 people in Gaza are either dead, injured, or missing, and presumed dead. And they say that 60% of the more than 27,000 fatalities reported by Gaza's health ministry have been women and children. UNICEF says that at least 17,000 kids in Gaza are unaccompanied or separated from their families and called it the most dangerous place in the world to be a child. Pretty haunting statistics there. About 85% of the 2.2 million people in Gaza have been displaced. A huge chunk of them have been forced into refugee camps in southern Gaza along the border. The population of Rafah, which is a city on the border of Egypt, is five times what it was before the war. And now Israeli authorities say they're going to expand operations into Rafah in the coming days. So that will be a catastrophe. That context is the backdrop for Secretary of State Tony Blinken's fifth visit to the Middle East that's happening right now. He met with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman on Monday. He's got stops in Egypt, Qatar, Israel, the West Bank. More on that in a second. But meanwhile, Ben, in Israel, the national security minister, this right-wing zealot named Itamar Ben-Gvir, told the Wall Street Journal that he would oppose any ceasefire deal that would free Palestinian prisoners being held on terrorism charges or end the war before Hamas was fully defeated. Remember, this is a guy who can pull his support from Netanyahu and topple the government anytime he wants. So a powerful lunatic, but powerful. Ben-Gvir also attacked Biden, saying, quote, "Instead of giving us his full backing, Biden is busy giving humanitarian aid and fuel to Gaza, which goes to Hamas. If Trump was in power, the U.S. conduct would be completely different." So it's very clear the Israelis.
A bit of a tell there.
Yeah. Ben-Gvir's son also tweeted that Biden has Alzheimer's. So cool family.
Yeah.
There was a little good news right before we started recording. All these Israeli politicians have asshole sons.
Netanyahu's son is a big
Yeah,
like
they
the
call
Don
him the Dauphin. Yeah, the Don Jr. of Israel. A little good news before we started recording. Qatar said they received a positive response from Hamas to the proposed ceasefire and hostage release deal. I suspect it's a counteroffer. It will take some time to kind of work through and negotiate, but fingers crossed. But Ben, stepping back, every week we come in here, the situation is worse. The IDF military campaign has failed to take out Hamas's leadership. It's failed to rescue any hostages. And yet neither the Israeli or U.S. approach changes a bit. I feel like I'm going to lose my fucking mind. It's like, at what point, what does it take for people to understand that none of this is working? And it's time to change course.
They have not rescued hostages. I mean,
not one. One in their opening days.
Okay. And meanwhile, you got a lot more out during a pause. And the Ben-Gvir comment about Hamas, we can all agree that, you know, we don't want Hamas to be running Gaza. We can all agree that we don't want there to ever be another October 7th. But Hamas is not going to be defeated. We've talked about this, but their leadership is in part out of Gaza. There are many different elements of Hamas in Gaza. They're not going to surrender. They're not going to say, you know, we're out of business now. And so this constant repetition of objectives that are militarily unattainable, the kind of military recovery of the hostages and the military destruction of Hamas, are the articulation of unattainable objectives, which is a recipe for an open-ended war,
right,
which is a recipe for the kind of catastrophic human suffering that you articulated in those statistics. And the fact that this is now kind of coming to Rafah, you know, at the same time that there have been some Israeli politicians, including people like Ben-Gvir, suggesting that what they really want to do is displace all these people into Egypt. You know, I mean, that starts to become more and more a question about what the intention is here as they kind of push south, as the population pushes south.
Sorry, that's Pundit barking incessantly.
Very opinionated dog.
Yeah, very angry dog. Wants a treat out there.
So, but I think we do have to just kind of keep coming back to the scale of human suffering, because it just points to the fact that getting in some more trucks of assistance is not the issue. The issue is the military operation, the nature of the military operation. Some aspects of that military operation have been dialed back from like at the height of the air campaign, but this is still, there are still people dying every single day. And as you said, I think the point we also want to come back to is because people will say, well, you know, isn't this, how can we trust this count? As you indicated, the count is probably low, okay? Because they can't get to every body under the rubble. Or some people say, well, what portion of these people that are a part of the count are Hamas? Well, 60% at least of these people are women and children. I don't think those people.
Yeah, the Israeli estimate of the number of Hamas fighters they've killed is like 10,000.
Yeah.
And the casualty count is 27,000. Yeah.
The point is, at some point, if the rationalization of this military campaign depends upon the dehumanization of the people who are dying, that may not be the intent of everybody who's rationalizing it, but it's the reality that when you have well over 10,000 kids dead, and tens of thousands of additional kids, we'll just focus on the children here, at risk of starvation in uninhabitable conditions, with over 80% of the housing units in Gaza either destroyed or damaged. What else is going on here? I mean, I don't know what else to say about it.
And the Biden people will say, look, we've really pushed hard on the Israelis to allow more aid into Gaza. And like, I'm sure that is true, but what does it say about your partner, your interlocutor there? You have to fight to allow in aid so everyone doesn't starve to death.
Yeah.
That's not a good setup.
If that's where the bar is here, the bar needs to be raised.
Also, Biden did put in place an executive order that will allow the United States to sanction violent settlers or those who support them, which I think is a big, important policy and executive order, but that is about the West Bank. It's not about what's happening in Gaza. A couple more things in Gaza, though. So CNN reported that the IDF is pumping large volumes of seawater into Hamas's tunnels. Not sure what that means for potential hostage rescue if they're in there. There's also concern that it could screw up the freshwater tables in the region, but it's happening. The New York Times just reported that Israeli intelligence thinks 32 of the 136 hostages have died, which is tragic and awful, but I think also why you always hear the debates about ceasefire and hostage release deal, including bodies of those who have passed away. The U.S. is reportedly pushing hard for a six-week ceasefire because they believe it will be impossible for Israel to fully ramp up operations again after that is over, which makes sense. And Axios reported today that the U.S. is working on a separate diplomatic agreement to calm tensions between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon. So that would, of course, be good. One other thing, Ben, so last week we talked about UNRWA, the aid organization that provides relief to Palestinians, especially in Gaza. It's basically the only organization that has boots on the ground in Gaza that can distribute aid. The U.S. suspended support to UNRWA after Israeli allegations that UNRWA employees were part of the October 7th attacks. There's been sort of a lot more review of that decision happening as we speak. I think the U.S. is kind of walking it back a bit, saying, well, actually, we gave them all the aid for this year already, right? So maybe this won't have an impact. But there you're seeing other countries kind of follow our lead, which is a problem. But here's a clip of Prime Minister Netanyahu elaborating on what he wants to see happen to UNRWA.
I think it's time that the international community and the UN itself understand that UNRWA's mission has to end. UNRWA is self-perpetuating. It is self-perpetuating also in its desire to keep alive the Palestinian refugee issue. And we need to get other UN agencies and other aid agencies replacing UNRWA if we're going to solve the problem of Gaza as we intend to do.
In that same press event, he also says that, you know, testimony from UNRWA employees were a big part of the ICJ genocide case. And it was interesting that he linked that with these concerns about UNRWA employees potentially being a part of Hamas or participating in the October 7th attacks. Again, the Israeli concerns about UNRWA are not new. But it was interesting to hear Netanyahu say he basically wants the organization dissolved. Like, that's his goal here.
Well, and here's what's happening ideologically. This is an important thing for people to understand about UNRWA and what Netanyahu was saying, because actually that doesn't have to do with whether or not some of them were in Hamas or not. Actually, it's bigger than that. So UNRWA was set up in the late 40s when the Nakba happened, when hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were displaced and turned into refugees. Mm-hmm. And by definition, refugees. They're driven from their homes. They're in camps. They're someplace else. The UN set up a special agency, UNRWA, to deal with those refugee populations, to provide services to them. The reason that Netanyahu and people of his ideological inclination in Israel want there to be no such thing as UNRWA anymore is because they don't want there to be any refugee status for Palestinians anymore.
Exactly.
Because if Palestinians are categorized as refugees, maybe they, you know, some of them obviously continue to argue they have a right to return to their homes.
Yep.
And obviously those homes are in Israel. Or, you know, even as refugees who aren't going to be able to return to Israel, they kind of stay where they are. What Netanyahu wants, and certainly Ben-Gvir wants, is he wants essentially those Palestinian populations, and he himself, by the way, said this, the clip we played last week back from the 70s was about there is a Palestinian state, essentially it's Jordan. Mm-hmm. He wants the Palestinians that are in Lebanon and Jordan to not be thought of as Palestinians, as refugees. He wants them to just be thought of as Arabs who live in Jordan or who live in Lebanon.
Right.
This is like a really important ideological point that he wants to kind of erase a certain international legal categorization of identity for Palestinians. They're no longer refugees. They're just people that live in Jordan. And that's it. And if you want to give them services, well, the UN has other bodies that can provide those services. And that's like a huge tell about what the ideological project is behind this. To people who think, you know, who may listen and think, well, you guys are hard on Israel. What I'd say is that I sincerely believe that the best outcome for Israel, the best way for Israel to live in peace with its neighbors is for there to be a Palestinian state. I think anybody, including myself, who's looked at that, doesn't think that you're going to have the right of return where everybody's going to move back to their homes in Israel proper. But you have to have a resettlement of those refugees in a new Palestinian state. And if you wipe out the categorization of them as refugees, you're wiping out essentially the idea of a Palestinian state. So I disagree with Netanyahu about this is not about even just Palestinian aspirations. It's about whether or not you think it's best for Israel to have there be a two-state solution. He clearly does not think that.
Yeah, he's this is a long-term project.
Yeah.
So let's talk about how public opinion of the war has changed in the U.S. There was an Associated Press poll the other day that found that half of U.S. adults think that Israel's war in Gaza has, quote, gone too far, and only 31% of U.S. adults approve of Biden's handling of the war in Gaza, including only 46% of Democrats. 33% of Republicans say Israel's military response has gone too far. That's up from 18% in November. So there's been a huge movement there, including 52% of independents are now in that place. NBC also did a big poll that came out over the weekend. There were some foreign policy questions. Trump defeats Biden by 11 points on the question of improving America's standing in the world. That used to be a strength for Biden. Only 29% approve of Biden's handling of the war in Gaza. It's down 5 points. And then among voters under 35 years old, only 15% approve of Biden's handling of the Israel-Hamas war. 70% disapprove. So like this war, obviously events are going very badly over in Israel, but the political impact it's having for Joe Biden and the prospect of re-election is incredibly damaging. And I think, you know, what we've talked about on this show is we know the administration is pushing hard behind the scenes for a ceasefire deal. They want a hostage release and some sort of negotiated solution, but they don't make those comments as forcefully in public. Politico reported that in private, Biden complains about Bibi Netanyahu. He calls him, quote, a bad fucking guy. And he worries out loud about the risk of Bibi dragging the U.S. into a wider Middle Eastern war because that conflict would buy Netanyahu more time politically to stay in power before Israeli voters push him out. All we're asking is say the shit in public,
yeah,
Joe.
Yeah,
like,
let's
we
go.
Agree with you. Yeah. We know it. Everyone knows this about Netanyahu. Every administration has hated Netanyahu since the 90s.
Yeah, except Trump. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, except for Trump. Yeah, yeah, that's a well point. But like, I mean, even Trump though soured on him after
Trump soured on him because he didn't back him on January 6th.
Yeah, and then he accused him of not supporting the Soleimani strike.
He basically treated Netanyahu like a Republican senator
like a
that didn't back him up on January 6th, which is kind of funny in a way.
That's exactly right.
But the politics of this are obvious, and they've been obvious for a while. You could have seen this coming. I think what's telling about that overall number, because we talked about how the biggest problem for re-election is the intensity felt by a sliver of the electorate, right? So it doesn't have to be like an overwhelming majority of Americans thinking something. The Democratic coalition is so fragile, you know, the margins are so thin that if a few tens of thousands of people in a few states are like, you know what, I'm out, I'm voting for a third party candidate, I'm sitting this out, Joe Biden will lose the election. And that's kind of, that's the thing that you should be most concerned about. I'm struck by the overall numbers, Tommy, because as much as I don't want to talk down the scale of our own audience, it's not like 51% of Americans are worldos here who are like following this really closely.
We don't know that's true.
But the reality is that just the background noise of what's happening has reached enough people that they're like, yeah, I don't know.
It's just scary images on TV.
Yeah. And it's scary images in a sense that we're getting dragged into something.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what, we're bombing Yemen now, and we're bombing Iraq, and we're bombing Syria. We bombed three different countries, you know. And so I think it's just, it should be a warning sign of why de-escalation is actually the better politics, even if it's not the thing that plays well in Washington day to day.
And foreign policy is not usually the drivers in elections until it is.
Until it's
Warren
bad.
Rock's front center, right? But you can watch, like, Biden's approval takes a huge hit around the Afghanistan withdrawal, and it's kind of fallen steadily ever since. There's a real demarcation there you can see in the average of polls.
Yeah, you don't really win on foreign policy, but you can lose on
Certainly can lose. Speaking of losing, Ben, there have been some terrible dehumanizing op-eds and articles written about the conflict in Gaza. There was a Wall Street Journal op-ed from the director of the Middle East Media Research Institute, which I've never heard of, calling Dearborn America's jihad capital. I wonder who funds them. Interesting to find out. And then Tom Friedman wrote an op-ed about how to understand the Middle East through this extended metaphor or comparison to the animal kingdom.
Yeah.
And I didn't read it until today because I was like, I saw the outrage. I didn't read the thing. I'm just genuinely shocked that an editor didn't say to him, like, hey, man, you've been around the block a while. Like, comparing countries and people to animals is going to land as dehumanizing to some people. Maybe just start over.
Yeah. And look, the first one, the Wall Street Journal one, was one of your classic AstroTurf organizations that, like you said, the funding is like, well, who are, there's always some group like this. You know, we had to, back in the day, it was like Frank Gaffney. Remember that guy?
Oh, that guy's crazy.
It was always like Islam Watch or something. And it was always, you know, super.
Now he's a centrist
bigoted
Republican.
now he's probably like a never Trumper. But yeah, maybe think about the idea of dehumanizing an entire city of people that, you know, it's a remarkable community, by the way, Dearborn. But then the Tom Friedman one is even more kind of baffling and astonishing, because comparing a whole region of people to the animal kingdom, and then also what the animals were like, wasps, and, you know,
the U.S. was an aging lion, right?
We got to be Mustafa and the Lion
Mustafa.
King, and then, you know, the bad guys, quote unquote, were, you know, all these various other animals, and it's a definition of dehumanization. I mean, literally, it's dehumanizing them and turning them animals. And to your point, it does, you know, speak to this kind of like lazy white guy kind of take. I got an idea. Like, we're gonna call them the animals, and actually, I kind of do like you. Kind of fault the like. Does anyone kind of look like give this a pass? Like, well, you
Lebanon,
know.
Yemen, and Syria, Iraq, they're caterpillars. What, Tom? What are you doing?
Yeah, like a creature you could step on. You know, and again, I'm sure Tom Friedman wasn't thinking that he was doing that. But to your point, that's when an editor comes in and is like, actually, can we get, maybe there's a different metaphor. Maybe there's a food metaphor. A historical analogy.
What if the world was flat?
But there's a metaphor.
What if you took a cab somewhere and talked to that person and then wrote up some shit? Yeah. Two quick things before we take a break. This has already been a long election year. It's going to be a long election year. If you need help get through it, pre-order our book, Democracy Reals. It's How to Save America in 10 Easy Steps. It is fun. It is funny. It is a useful guide to getting involved in politics and making a difference. Plus, Kirkin is going to donate its profits from the book to support Vote Save America and other organizations mobilizing for progressive outcomes in the 2024 election. Democracy or Else is available on June 25th, but you can pre-order now. Go to Kirkin.com/books, Kirkin.com/books, or wherever books are sold. And if you buy now, you help us get on the New York Times bestseller list, maybe. So check it out. Also, we're making a ton of great content here at Kirkin. If you're not checking out our YouTube, you are leaving prime content on the table. Hysteria has a great series called This Fucking Guy, where they roast some of the worst men in the country. I have a show with Brian Tyler Cohen called Liberal Tears, where we rank stupid things happening in the world, terrible people. We have a lot of fun. It's very fun. We actually humiliate each other at the end. And then Lovett has a new segment called What a Weekday, where he jokes about early breaking news of the week. So go to crooked.com/videos to watch now. Support for Pod Save the World comes from the International Rescue Committee. The IRC works in more than 50 countries, serving people whose lives have been upended by war, conflict, and natural disasters. In places like Gaza, Ukraine, and Sudan, displaced families are experiencing war, extreme hunger, and life-threatening injuries. In Gaza, ongoing violence, bombardment, and blockade have made survival difficult for families living in damaged buildings and tents. The lack of safe water, medicine, and healthy food contributes to the spread of diseases, and children are especially at risk. The International Rescue Committee is working with local partners in Gaza to provide life-saving medical care to injured civilians. The IRC works around the world to help families in crisis by delivering critical supplies such as therapeutic food for malnourished children, clean water, cash assistance, and more. Your donation will support this work and help children and families survive. Listen, the International Rescue Committee is an incredible organization. They are doing the Lord's work all around the globe. I have donated to them, you know, for many, many years now because I know that my dollar will go towards helping people. It's not going to go to administrative costs or overhead fees. It's just an incredible group doing great work. I hope you'll consider them. Donate today by visiting rescue.org/rebuild. That's rescue.org/rebuild.
The constant political chaos can be a lot. You got to mix it up with a little regular chaos. Go behind the pods with Terminally Online, Cricket's loosest show, where the news takes a backseat to the unscripted antics of your favorite Pod Save America and Cricket Media hosts and staffers. Hear Lovett learning about dating apps.
I was single in my 20s, and then yada, 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 I was single in my 40s.
Listen to my sage advice on being kind to retail workers. Just smile, walk away. You don't have a right to be an asshole. And enjoy Tommy celebrating the unrelenting wheel of time.
Time comes for all of us. You will all be out of touch with the culture. You'll all be asking someone what some equivalent of a Yassified means.
Terminally Online is a subscriber-exclusive show. To get access, subscribe to our Friends of the Pod community at crooked.com/friends.
So, Ben, sticking in Washington, so a lot of Biden's foreign policy priorities are now tied up in this fight over immigration and supplemental funding requests in Congress.
Great PSA, by the way.
Oh, just yesterday?
I recommend Pod Save America. It's very good.
This show's fine. So remember,
this show's better, but, you know.
So remember, like, the MAGA Republicans, they've decided that Ukraine is bad, supporting Ukraine is bad. So Biden tried to link funding for Ukraine with a supplemental funding request for Israel to make it politically palatable or at least hard to vote against. Republicans said, no way. We're not going to provide more funding for Ukraine until we secure our own border. So Senator James Lankford, this conservative Republican from Oklahoma, worked with Democrats like Chris Murphy, friend of the pod from Connecticut, to negotiate an immigration bill. And then they released the final text of that bill on Sunday. It had immigration. It had Ukraine. It had Israel funding. It had Indo-Pacific countering China funding, the whole smorgasbord. And then it took like 12 hours, 24 hours for Republicans to immediately walk away from the bill, including Lankford, who wrote the bill, negotiated the thing, and now won't say whether he supports his own bill. Mitch McConnell portrays himself as a cold warrior, staunch supporter of Ukraine. He instantly caved under pressure from Trump, who said this bill would be a gift to Biden because he wants to run on the border being a mess. So, Ben, Ukraine got a little bit of good news recently. EU leaders achieved a breakthrough on a deal to provide 50 billion euros to Ukraine through 2027. They had to overcome opposition from Viktor Orban in Hungary, which is not easy, but they did it. But this bill in the Senate contains 60 billion for Ukraine, 14 billion for Israel, 10 billion for humanitarian aid for conflict zones, including Gaza, and billions to counter China in the Pacific. And like, people need to understand, this is existential for Ukrainians. Like, there are reports that the Ukrainian military is running out of ammo on the battlefield as we speak. They may lose the battle for the city of Avdiivka. And so I don't know. I guess I'm just sort of like at a loss. If that combination of policies can't get Republican support, what will? Like, how do you get these people to be serious and actually govern? I'm out of ideas.
Yeah. You saw kind of the Mike Johnson, I always forget the guy's name.
Speaker Johnson, yeah.
Speaker Johnson. You know, he suggested that he wanted to put up a clean bill of just the Israel aid, right?
Yeah, he pulling up the $17.6 billion for Israel.
And again, like, we've been hard on Biden. Like, good message from Biden that he would veto that standalone bill and not kind of succumb to the cynicism of kind of pushing that through. some also good moves potentially from the Biden administration to try to find other ways to get some assistance to Ukraine. Like there's excess stockpiles of U.S. weapons in Europe that maybe you can redirect under existing authorities to the Ukrainians. But just so people understand this, I mean, this isn't just, you know, some new fancy capability we're going to give the Ukrainians. This isn't like, oh, we're going to send them F-16s. This is like the basic nuts and bolts artillery, the stuff that if you're on the Ukrainian front line right now and you've been fighting your fucking ass off for 2 years,
2 years
to save your country, to stand up to Vladimir Putin, and you've gotten waves of like Wagner Group convicts coming at you. You've got the Russians bombing your kids, you know, in your homes back behind you. And you're sitting there and all of a sudden, like someone's going to tell you, you know what, actually, like we have a quarter of the artillery that we need because
Marjorie Taylor
some fucking
Green.
MAGA people are trying to make a point and Donald Trump needs to run on the border, I would be losing my mind. I can't imagine. I mean, I think we should, you know, we were texting about this, like, just be clear about the empathy we feel to the Ukrainians who've done everything that they've been asked and have sacrificed, you know, 70,000 casualties at least, like everything on the line. And there's some dumb political game in Washington. And look, even if you're skeptical of Ukraine aid, and I think you and I are very open to like diplomatic approaches, and I don't think any of those are going to happen before the election anyway, because Putin's going to wait for that, and we can talk about that in the context of our buddy Tucker. But even if you're skeptical about it, as a country, we have like led these people to believe that we're there for them.
Right.
And so whether you agree with the approach in Ukraine or not, leading these people to believe that we're there, we're in the fight, here you go, here's the spigot of weapons that are coming your way so you can get in this fight, to turn that off in the middle,
just pull the rug out,
is totally reprehensible. It's totally like cutting those people loose when they're in a life and death situation. I usually, as you know, refrain from the like, something happens over here in the world and the other people over here are going to look at that and think you're not reliable. I actually make an exception to that rule in this case, where I usually object to that. It's like, oh, if we bomb this country over here, this other country will be, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
This is more just like, do we keep agreements? You know, right. And to lead a country to believe that we're there for them and then remove it. And this is not at all Joe Biden's fault or anybody in his administration. This is entirely on these MAGA people. It's so reprehensible. And it's not kind of breaking through because people substantively are obviously interested in the border. Politically, they're interested in our election. Just spare a thought for like what this means for the Ukrainians. It's good that the EU, it's a good test that they stood up and were like, you know what? At a minimum, we're going to come on and kick in essentially about the same amount of money that the Americans were committing, I mean, you know, between 55 and 60 billion. Some of that, though, is for like supporting the Ukrainian government. The Europeans cannot make the Ukrainians whole on things like artillery. Like they just don't have the capacity and the pace to do it. So it is what it is, and it sucks is the truth.
It's terrible. And this bill that was negotiated in the Senate is like the Republican wish list.
It's what they including, want. Including, by the way, support for Ukraine used to be something that was on their wish list.
It is the worst politics.
Israel, Taiwan, literally like it's like a right-wing Republican bill.
I know Favreau made fun of me a little bit for suggesting this, but I do wonder, I mean, being tough on China is like the number one thing that pops in all these Republican kind of primary ads and polling. I do wonder if you can portray Republican opposition to this bill as being soft on China in some sort of effective way. I don't know. It's kind of a bank shot. It would require, you know, some nimble messaging to make it work, but I'd rather try.
If we had put this bill forward in like 2015, in the Obama years, people would have thought we'd lost our minds and like somehow the White House got hijacked by Dick Cheney. Like this is, it's bonkers. And maybe, Tommy, what needs to be done is someone needs to let Hugh Hewitt know that, not to be too inside worldo here, but that there's ships.
Funding for
Indo-Pacific ships. I don't even know if that's in the bill, but like we just, you know.
Maybe we just send Hugh to the Indo-Pacific. He can find out for himself. Lots of news out of Ukraine itself too, Ben. So President Zelensky said he's considering a shakeup, not just of the military, but also his political leadership. So last week, there was some reports that he summoned his top general to tell him he'd been fired. Then he seemed to back off that firing. And now it looks like the shakeup might be happening and might be even bigger. Zelensky gave an interview to an Italian TV station over the weekend, and he said, "A reset, a new beginning is necessary. I have something serious in mind, which is not about a single person, but about my direction of the country's leadership." So, you know, there's a bunch of things at play here. You know, he might be firing, you know, the folks who were in charge of the failed counteroffensive as a way to show that, you know, they're learning from that mistake. They may just be kind of increasingly at odds with each other, Zelensky and his top generals. Additionally, though, obviously the country is sick of being at war. There's concern about a new mobilization effort that would bring up to 500,000 new conscripts into the fight. There's reports about corruption. Last week, the Ukrainian Security Service announced that it uncovered a $40 million corruption scheme among military officials who signed a contract for 100,000 artillery shells, none of which were ever delivered. I don't know if you saw, Masha Gessen has a piece in the New Yorker this week.
It's good.
Yeah,
good.
About democratic backsliding in Ukraine. Yeah. The pieces of that are basically, I mean, it's a long piece, but there's the martial law declaration that's been in place since the day after the invasion that controls who can and can't enter the country. The media has been tightly regulated by the government and taken over in some instances. They can't have elections because it's not safe and because like a huge chunk of the population is out of Ukraine. So Ben, I mean, none of us like want to fly spec a country at war or a leader at war. Zelensky has clearly shown like unimaginable courage in the face of, you know, the invasion and occupation. But you know, historically speaking, crises like this can lead to political leaders becoming entrenched and some democratic backsliding. How do you think the U.S. and mostly the EU probably should handle these delicate conversations about, you know, supporting Ukraine in this time of crisis, but also not letting it change its like fundamental identity?
There's a lot that's been going on and that's a good summary. Clearly, Zelensky and the top general, Zaluzhny, is that pronounced right?
I didn't even try.
Looking over at Alona.
I asked for pronunciation, and I just whiffed on it. Yeah, just producer, like, I can't even speak.
But the General Zaluzhny, who's a top commander, is hugely popular in Ukraine. Is more popular than Zelensky. And I think there's long been a thought that that was like a source of tension, that you essentially had, these are the two most popular people in Ukraine. I don't know if General Zaluzhny has any political ambitions or not. What is the case is that if Zelensky was the guy who, you know, helped save Ukraine by not leaving the initial days and showing such courage and then mobilizing kind of this world assistance, General Zaluzhny is the guy who came up with this ingenious strategy, essentially, of like baiting the Russians into extending their supply lines and then just relentlessly attacking the supply lines.
Right.
I'm not a military guy. Like, you know, I played Risk like some people. Mm. I obviously was in a lot of these conversations in the sit room, but I wasn't like making military strategy. But I know enough to know that this guy like made a lot of, you know, right calls.
Yeah.
He also did the kind of fake offensive in the south before the offensive in the north. So clearly this guy knows what he's doing.
Yeah. But lately, they've been kind of not on the same page.
They've not
publicly
been on the same page.
He did an
page,
interview, I think, with The Economist.
The Bakhmut thing, remember? There was like, why are we like so focused on this place? And who knows? Maybe, precisely because I'm not a military strategist, sometimes you need to change commanders, even if they're great commanders. A different phase of the war might need a new person. I don't know. What is concerning is when you have like this kind of, you know, clearly Zelensky wants him gone, but he's not willing to kind of push him out. He's probably suggested, it seems like from reports, that he should resign, but he doesn't want to resign.
Right.
That kind of civil-military tension is just uncomfortable given the stakes for the Ukrainians. And then I think in terms of the broader question about like Zelensky himself or just the risk of corruption as the war goes on, because we should be clear, it's not like Ukraine had like solved all those problems with corruption in its military and its political system. I think the EU can be really important here because however,
part of joining.
Yeah, however this war is going to end, and it may end in an unsatisfying kind of frozen conflict in a year or two in a negotiation, the best carrot right now, the best incentive for the Ukrainians is EU membership.
Yep.
It's not the same thing as NATO, but it's in some ways more important for them as a country to be in that bloc. A lot comes with that. A lot comes with that in terms of the rule of law, in terms of civil-military relations, in terms of corruption. And I just think the EU providing, and especially given that they just kicked in all this assistance, they can be the, you know, the sunlight, the transparency, and the incentive for there not to be backsliding. And so I hope that this is something that, that can be a real European focus, and the U.S. can obviously reinforce it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Speaking of revered military leaders, Tucker Carlson is in Moscow with David Sachs, probably now he's alone. This afternoon, he announced in a video posted on Twitter that he has interviewed Vladimir Putin. Here's a clip of Tucker talking about why they went to Moscow for this interview.
Here's why we're doing it. First, because it's our job. We're in journalism. Our duty is to inform people. 2 years into a war that's reshaping the entire world, most Americans are not informed. They have no real idea what's happening in this region, here in Russia or 600 miles away in Ukraine. But they should know. They're paying for much of it in ways they might not fully yet perceive. The war in Ukraine is a human disaster. It's left hundreds of thousands of people dead, an entire generation of young Ukrainians, and it's depopulated the largest country in Europe. But the long-term effects are even more profound. This war has utterly reshaped the global military and trade alliances, and the sanctions that followed have as well. And in total, they have upended the world economy. The post-World War II economic order, the system that guaranteed prosperity in the West for more than 80 years, is coming apart very fast, and along with it, the dominance of the U.S. dollar. These are not small changes. They are history-altering developments. They will define the lives of our grandchildren.
So Tucker also says in this little clip, quote, not a single Western journalist has bothered to interview the president of the other country involved in this conflict, Vladimir Putin. Now, I actually don't have a problem with Tucker interviewing Putin. I don't think it'll be a good interview. I don't think he'll ask him the right questions. I don't think we'll learn anything from it. But as like a general matter, I'm not someone who's going to shout down someone for doing an interview. That said, that claim that no other journalist has tried is utter bullshit. I'm sure dozens of them have tried. Christiane Amanpour immediately said she's been trying to interview Putin since the day the war started. What is far more interesting is why Putin would give an interview to Tucker. I suspect it's a couple of factors. One, he obviously knows that Tucker opposes U.S. support for Ukraine, that Tucker is influential in Republican circles. He's probably trying to help stymie this supplemental funding bill that's going through Congress right now. He's trying to help Trump because Putin prefers Trump. We know that. But there's also a bigger picture, Ben, that I think Putin's conservative, white, religious, ethno-nationalist worldview is a lot more like Tucker's worldview than I think Tucker's fans would care to admit, or then Tucker is really alike Joe Biden, for example, at least at this point in his career.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, first of all, something weird with Tucker, you know, he always says like we and our.
I know, like it's the royal we, like him and his producer.
He's just a guy, like, I know. And he's not even like a network. Website. I guess he's got some people with him, so maybe he's a good team leader.
Team at TuckerCarlson.com.
It does seem like a royal we.
Grating, yeah.
I think the two key points here are, one, Tucker will say some things that you find yourself like agreeing with. He's like, Americans have no idea like how fucking crazy this war is, and hundreds of thousands of people have died, and it's had these huge consequences. That's true. And I kind of appreciate when Tucker has this kind of disgust for war and stuff, but Putin's the guy who did the war. Like what's so maddening about listening to him is it's not like the Ukrainians like invaded Russia, you know.
Right.
Even if you're somebody who thinks that like we shouldn't have given Ukrainian like NATO membership, like Vladimir Putin invaded this country and he acts like that didn't happen, like the war broke out or something.
Putin also went through like five different stated reasons why, right? It was like Nazis were committing genocide against Russian speakers. Like there's all this bullshit early on. They just abandoned its rationale.
And he also, I mean, he has another piece in this video which I watched, unfortunately, where he talks about like he's doing this for free speech. Well, guess who doesn't have free speech? Any journalist in Russia, right? So anyway, that's obvious. I think the more interesting point is when you ended on, which is the ideology of this. And there's a bit of a tell in that, you know, when he talks about the system that guaranteed prosperity in the West, you know, this is a guy like Putin's ideological project, which we haven't talked about in a while, but we've talked about a lot in the past, is essentially this kind of white Christian nationalist, right? It's anti-LGBT, it's anti-Muslim, it's anti, you know, he's taken up the cancel culture cause, you know? But he really is this kind of, you know, white supremacist. Putin is like a white supremacist, right? And I think Tucker really truly believes that we should be allies with Putin, right? And actually Vivek weirdly gave, you know, that somehow we're going to flip Putin against the Chinese, that essentially the
5D chess.
I think these guys naturally believe that, like, there's this kind of white Christian guy, like, in Moscow, like, yeah, maybe they're Orthodox Christians, but, like, they're all on the kind of white team, the Christian team, and Orban, and we hate Muslims, and we hate gay people, and we hate, you know, Taylor Swift and, you know, Travis Kelce. Yeah. You know, like, I wouldn't be surprised if Tucker asked about that, but, like, that's truly what these people believe. And, and I think the reason the interview is useful is I think it does illuminate that that's the stakes, like, in this election. You know, it's about the war in Ukraine, but it's also basically, like, if Trump wins, like, that's actually what we're going to be doing. We're going to be like, you know what? Yeah, we're with this far right kind of white nationalist Christian, us versus everybody else. And the dollar has to be strong to, like, control the economies of the global South. You know, this is, again, like, it's a coherent worldview. Like, I actually give Tucker, credit's the wrong word, but at least he says the quiet part out loud, because you can then, like, think about it and respond to it in ways that the MAGA people in Congress are too dumb to know.
Yeah.
They don't even really know the ideological project they're part of. Tucker actually articulates what this ideological project is all about. And I think that is pretty much where Trump is. You know, Trump himself maybe not, like, smart enough to fully realize exactly what he's doing, but I think he instinctively gets it, you know, and that's why I'm actually interested to see this interview. And look, they've been running Tucker on Russian TV. So, like, he's actually a familiar face.
Yeah, he's well-known.
Because if you watch all these, you know, bloodthirsty Russian TV channels, they always have, like, some Tucker segments. So he's kind of a Russian TV personality, too.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we'll watch the interview when it comes out. We'll probably talk about it next week. You know, we'll see if he asks Putin about the death toll in Ukraine, or, you know, the lies about defeating Nazis.
Or Alexei Navalny, or yeah,
Navalny,
journalism in Russia.
Evan, you know, Gershkovich, yeah. Like, journalists that are, including American journalists, that are in prison. But I don't think he will.
Yeah. Or he might. And then, you know, Putin's actually not, he gives some weird, like, creepy answer. You know, he kind of half smiles and he's like, oh, we will see what happens to our friend. You know, like,
And it's me through a translation. It'll be hard to, like, push back in real time. But, yeah, we'll see. Anyway.
I'm looking for the Tucker reaction shot. So does he do the kind of befuddled, that look he gives people, you
or
know?
The like kind of childish giggle.
Yeah.
Oh, Vlad, so funny. All right, a couple more things. We're running a little long, but that's okay. So, Ben, El Salvador held elections this past Sunday, and the incumbent Rafael Bukele claimed a landslide victory, even though the votes are still technically being counted. But you know, also little side note here: the Constitution does not allow a president to serve consecutive terms, so this was not, you know, not what he was supposed to be doing. Bukele put his country into a state of emergency 2 years ago to take on gang violence, and it has both made him super popular and has done incredible damage to civil liberties. More than 75,000 people have been arrested, and human rights organizations warn that thousands of innocent people have been swept up in the crackdown and are just rotting in jails. Secretary of State Tony Blinken responded to the election on Twitter Monday, writing, "We look forward to continuing to prioritize good governance, inclusive economic prosperity, fair trial guarantees, and human rights in El Salvador." So Tony, I think, sees the writing on the wall there that Bukele likely won the election, even if there were some inconsistencies in the reporting and in the way it went down. And that statement is obviously kind of a aspirational set of things we hope to collaborate with El Salvador on. We spoke with Luis Villarreira, a democracy activist from El Salvador who founded an organization called Tracoda, which focuses on building technological tools to combat corruption and foster democracy, about Bukele's reelection. Here's a clip.
I'm wearing black, like all black, because it seems right, because they killed democracy in El Salvador with the reelection that is not in the constitution, is unconstitutional. The problem is that at some point, everything is going to implode and then or explode in the country, and that is going to result in migration. We already see that with Venezuela, with Cuba. And for sure, this is not going to be sustainable in the long run. Like the exception state having like almost 3% of the population in jail without due process, and how people is like saying, okay, the international community is saying it's okay to do that. And the thing is, like, other countries in the Western Hemisphere are adopting these measures. In Ecuador, they try to do the same. In Honduras, they try to do the same. So, yeah, and in his speech, for example, he attacked international communities. He attacked nonprofits. He attacked civil society organizations and journalists. So that's something that we need to be afraid of, because things are going to get worse.
So Ben, we've talked about Bukele a lot on the show. I mean, his sort of tenure is marked by these crackdowns where he just throws people in jail, whether or not they're accused of anything, and also his embrace of Bitcoin and the idiots in the United States who, you know, sort of like took that at face value and supported him. But pretty troubling that this super authoritarian approach to policing has made Bukele by far the most popular leader in Latin America.
In the whole hemisphere. I mean, yeah, he polls by far. 80%. I mean, he's legit popular. And look, we could be too glib about the guy because the crypto stuff and the hat backwards kind of, but he actually had like Tucker, he has like an approach, right? And the approach is just autocracy and strongman politics and lock people up, and clearly that approach is working politically for him, and it's working substantively in the sense that violence is way down, actually. El Salvadorian migration to the U.S. border is way down. It's like the only country where you've seen a huge drop. But I actually think Luis in the clip puts his finger on it. I just think that's a sugar high. You know, like when you bottle things up like this and you put 3% of the country in prison and you just, you know, dismantle democracy, the bill is going to come due, you know?
Yeah.
And if I was an ordinary Salvadorian right now, I might be like, well, things are better. Like this guy, you know, the gangs aren't in charge anymore. It's safer on the streets. But then you look up in 5 years and you've got like a corrupt despot and he's, you know, there's some version of the gangs back.
Your totally innocent cousin in jail.
And you have no recourse anymore because the democracy is gone. So you can't vote him out. And that's what's so scary about these moments is, yes, people want to say, well, he is democratically the most popular guy. Well, he just changed the constitution basically to let himself stay in power. And if you think that the first thing he's going to do now is not to further dismantle democracy, you don't pay attention to these things. And again, I think Luis, what's going to need to happen is some kind of long-term building of some alternative here because, I don't know, I could be proven wrong, but I just have a feeling that this approach in the long run and in the long run might be a few years, you suddenly what felt really good for a couple of years, you look up and you're like, oh, fuck.
Strongmen don't always wear well over time. Yeah. Big picture, Ben, looking forward, 2024 is going to be a big test for the future of democracy all over the world, including the United States. A couple races and data points that we're watching. So first, there were some polls recently out of Europe that are forecasting far-right parties are going to gain a number of seats during the EU elections in June. That is troubling, and that rise in these far-right parties is going to come with the center-left parties taking a big hit. Second, Pakistan is holding an election on February 8th, but it is shaping up to be anything but free and fair. So former Prime Minister Imran Khan has been sentenced to 10 years in prison for allegedly leaking state secrets. A lot of people think that sentence is just a pretext for the Pakistani military to crack down on Khan and put restrictions on his political party, like removing their logo from the ballots, etc. There's all kinds of shit happening. And then third, in Senegal, President Macky Sall signed a decree postponing their election. It was supposed to be on February 25th, but it's been pushed. The government is also disqualifying opposition candidates and restricted internet access on mobile phones after protesters took to the streets. So, Ben, we're talking about very different countries, regions of the world here, systems of government in some cases. But the common theme is a threat to democracy and democratic norms and a trajectory that does not feel very good.
Yeah, the year of elections is not off to a roaring start for democracy. Great. I mean, I think you're right to point out that these places are different, and we're right to put this in the same segment because what is so troubling is countries as different as El Salvador and Senegal and Pakistan are all showing that they're kind of part of this trend of essentially extrajudicial approaches to politics, right? Bukele changes the law, lets himself stay in office. The Pakistani military, whomever is like, you know, orchestrating Imran Khan's removal from the scene to kind of pick the leader however they want. And in Macky Sall, like he was the guy that he had surprised people in a good way by saying he wasn't going to run for this third term. Everybody's happy about that. I think we welcome that on this show. And actually, like weirdly, like his party was already primed to kind of win. So it's just ambiguous like why he's doing this. And again, keep in mind, this is in West Africa. ECOWAS is the regional group of countries that includes all these coup states, and Senegal's usually the more, you know, advanced, committed to democracy in the neighborhood. So it does just tell you where the pendulum's going, and it's not going in the direction of the small D Democrats.
You know? Not great. Yeah. Not great. But let's turn to Northern Ireland, where it was a historic weekend.
Yes, this is a
little good. So for the first time in 100 years, the top job of first minister is going to be held by a nationalist member of the Sinn Féin party, Michelle O'Neill. Sinn Féin has historic ties to the IRA, the former extremist group. Well, I guess still an extremist group. But this is a, you know, so it's a huge moment for them in their evolution into politics from something else. Recent polls across Ireland suggest a majority of people still do not support unification. But the very fact that O'Neill was appointed to the position would have been unthinkable until recent years. This once fringe political wing of the IRA won the popular vote in 2020. And they've gained momentum among young people in particular by supporting causes like housing and representing a shift away from the status quo. Here's a clip from O'Neill's appointment.
I am honoured to stand here as First Minister. We mark a moment of equality and a moment of progress, a new opportunity to work and to grow together. Confident in that wherever we come from, whatever our aspirations are, we can and we must build our future together.
So, Ben, what do you think this means for the future in Northern Ireland?
First of all, I could listen to
all day.
Any, you know, can we get some more Irish clips on the show? Any Irish voice.
It's my fault. You know? That clip started 60 seconds. I cut it down for time, but I wish I hadn't.
Also, Michelle O'Neill, not to be confused with Michael O'Neill, very good.
Former roommate of mine.
Look, it's a huge deal. I mean, to have someone, you know, Sinn Féin, obviously legacy IRA, you know, they go on this political journey to the Good Friday Accords. And to have her standing up there, and talking about, I mean, number one, the fact that someone from Sinn Féin is giving a message like that, like, I want to govern for everybody. And I'm sure, you know, maybe there are people on the other team that don't believe that.
Right.
But just the fact that that's the kind of political orientation, I think, is important and powerful. And it's, look, if you're going to have a Good Friday Accord and you're going to have power sharing, you're going to have a Sinn Féin leader at some point, you know, or else what is it really? It's not really power sharing. And at the same time, the fact that she's trying to identify this agenda that, you know, whether you're Catholic or Protestant or Republican, you know, unification person or not, you care about housing, you care about education, you care about the economy, that's smart. I do think that this question lurks in the backdrop. This is also post-Brexit, right? Mm-hmm. And so part of the reason that Sinn Féin won this election is because of the post-Brexit politics of Northern Ireland. And, you know, some of the Sinn Féin has a presence in the Irish Parliament too, and some of them are like, well, this is great. We can finally see unification on the horizon. I do think that at some point, and I'm not taking a position on this, I swear to God.
Come on.
I'm just saying at some point in the not too distant future, I don't think there's going to be, you know, necessarily this will be an issue. Like, this is going to, you know, God forbid, hopefully not a violent one, but,
right.
But like, I do think, you know, at some point Brexit made this more of an issue because people in Northern Ireland, a lot of them want to be in the EU, you know? And so I don't think that's the headline of what's happening here, but it is in the backdrop.
Yeah. To the extent the Good Friday Agreement kind of healed the wound, it was pretty recently. We're talking about the 90s.
Yeah,
you know, this isn't like ancient history. Yeah. So pretty remarkable evolution.
Interesting, too, that she actually, in that same talk, I think, called for a ceasefire and expressed solidarity to the Palestinians.
Yeah.
It reminds you that there's this kind of solidarity.
Anti-occupation.
You know, ANC, yeah. IRA, yep. You know, it was an interesting callback to that era.
Yeah. And, you know, Ben, look, I know the Irish aren't the biggest fans of the monarchy as a general matter.
Great transition.
Thank you. But I suspect many of them were still saddened to hear the news that King Charles has been diagnosed
with
some type of cancer. Come on. So I guess he was being treated for an enlarged prostate when doctors discovered some cancer elsewhere in his body. We don't know exactly what's going on. But to King Charles's credit, he went public with this news in an effort to encourage others to get screenings. In the past, royal health news has kind of stayed within the palace and not necessarily been public. So, like, good on him for going public with this. You don't have to be a monarch fan to know that it's actually a good thing if you have to have a monarch to have one who's like really, really interested in combating climate change, for example, which King Charles is. So I think, you know, he can be a force for good if he wants to be. I'm not saying I'm like a pro monarchy guy.
Charles
in any way.
Stan over here. Yeah. No, you're right. You're right. I mean, like, he, like, there's a lot, the monarchy we can talk about, and Charles has, you know, had some hiccups along the way. There's a, you know, but,
hiccups.
But as a public figure, like, he's embraced climate change. He's embraced kind of mental health. He's embracing health transparency. That's good. And frankly, it's just a human. Like, seriously, like, you know, Kate, you know, just had some nasty health bout, you know, she was hospitalized for a while. now, Charles, it is, you know, it's been a rough year for the royals. I mean, I genuinely mean that. I mean, Queen Elizabeth dying and now all these health issues. I saw world correspondent of me saw that Harry is going to see his
flying father. Back to see dad.
Yeah. So who knows? Maybe we'll get a reconciliation.
Which honestly makes me a little worried about what the prognosis is, right? If you like jump on a plane and immediately fly home, that makes you worry. It's kind of serious.
That's true, actually. And that, like, yeah, I really hope that's not the case. And I was going to say something about another season of The Crown, but now I realize that that's probably in poor taste.
Yeah, you do you. Last segment, we're going to do a little something called Conservative Politicians Are Weird. So this is according to a report in the Sunday Times, Ben. British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak fasts for 36 hours at the start of every single week. He only drinks water, tea, or black coffee from 5 p.m. on Sunday to 5 a.m. on Tuesday. Obviously, when you are starving, your body breaks down fat and not energy or carbohydrates. Some people think this diet helps you live longer, but that science is like based on starving mice and shit. So I don't know. All I know is that, like, first of all, Rishi Sunak, like, you're kind of a beanpole. So I don't know that you need to be starving yourself for, 36 hours. But also, if I fasted for 16 hours, let alone 36, I would be in the worst mood imaginable. I can't even imagine doing that.
Well, you should have some of that, like, what did we used to endorse, the Athletic Greens? Can you have that?
I don't know. That sounds like you're cheating.
That is part of, I guess that's cheating.
It's not tea.
I'd add to the weird Rishi Sunak and British Tories segment too, that do you see the like 1,000-pound bet that Piers Morgan made with him about whether any planes would go to Rwanda? Like, it was very odd to see like a prime minister like shaking hands to bet Piers Morgan 1,000 pounds about sending people to Rwanda.
Was it Mitt Romney who bet somebody like $10,000? You try to bet someone $10,000 on stage during a debate. Yeah, he tried to bet that idiot, Rick Perry. Listen, when you're a fucking...
When you're a rich dude.
Rich,
yeah, exactly. That's right.
Like, half a billionaire. Don't bet someone 1,000 pounds.
If you are Rishi Sunak, who's half a billionaire and who presides over a party that is fucking destroyed the NHS, National Health Service, through austerity, maybe you don't just like drop 1,000-pound bets on whether you can send some migrants on a plane to Rwanda.
Yeah, you can send some destitute people fleeing persecution, whether you can send them to a country they've never been to, never heard of, don't speak the language, and don't own it. Hey, I bet you $1,000 I can torture these people before
election. This is the kind of thing that I see, and I kind of like, it'd be fun to be in the Labour campaign.
Oh my God, I would just destroy
him. Because he's such a big, easy, skinny target, but yeah, like it's a big target, you know? Like.
Yeah, so sticking with this theme, Ben, former British Prime Minister Liz Truss is speaking at CPAC this year. So for those who don't know, CPAC stands for the Conservative Political Action Conference. It is this far-right conference that Republicans host. It was once like kind of fringe and wacky, kind of like the bar scene from Star Wars, the Republican
Borat
Party.
Was showing up or something.
Now it's like MAGA centrist, right? It's just kind of like the Trump show. I'm kind of interested to see how this goes because I'm not sure that these little like culture war freaks want to hear from a boring loser who was prime minister for 50 days before being bounced out of office. Like, I don't know. That's not like the kind of leadership they're looking for down at CPAC.
Yeah. Why is she? I guess she wanted to cut taxes a lot, so they like her. I just don't understand. Like, what is the appeal when you're in the CPAC meeting? Okay, let's put ourselves in the whatever brainstorm. You know. And you're going through all the list of potential speakers. And it's kind of like the Dr. Evil headquarters Austin Powers. Or
you're like, all right, we got Dan Bongino.
Or deep callback, like the Naked Gun opening, you know?
Okay, yeah.
Like, but you got a wall with all the potential speakers. And we got Orban over here. And
Don Jr.
Maybe Bukele make an appearance if we ask him. And is there some like right-wing, like RSS, like Hindu nationalists, if we want to come speak or something. Like you have all these people to choose from. Yeah. Ben Gavir.
Who was at that neo-Nazi meeting in Eastern Germany that caused all that trouble?
Get one of them. Like, why would you basically be like, actually the person we want is Liz Truss.
Liz Truss.
You
know? And maybe a decade ago, you're like, oh, there's some prestige from a former prime minister, but like you got Trump. Yeah. You got Orban.
I'm sure you got Nigel Farage. I'm sure he's going to be there.
Bolsonaro will probably be there.
Oh, Bolsonaro will be there, like, spreading COVID, you know.
I mean, the serious part of this is there is this just, like, connective tissue between all these, like, sort of fringe, super right-wing nationalists, usually racist leaders. I mean, Liz Truss, I'm not saying that she was specifically racist. I've talked about some of the others at CPAC. But
she was just kind of ridiculous.
She's just an idiot. She's put forward a tax plan and it tanked the entire economy.
This almost broke the Bank of England after like hundreds
of
years.
Wild story. But yeah, I mean, I guess she's been spotted in Congress, I think, having meetings with Tea Party types.
I think the extreme tax cut caucus like likes her because she was willing to break the global economy to cut taxes, I guess. I don't know.
Bizarre.
Very strange.
All right. Well, that's enough of, you know, weirdo conservative Tories. But we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to hear from Alex Ward. He's a writer for Politico and the author of the new book, The Internationalists, which is about President Biden's first 2 years in office and his foreign policies. Stick around for that.
The constant political chaos can be a lot. You got to mix it up with a little regular chaos. Go behind the pods with Terminally Online, Cricket's loosest show, where the news takes a backseat to the unscripted antics of your favorite Pod Save America and Cricket Media hosts and staffers. Here, love it, learning about dating apps.
I was single in my 20s, and then yada, 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 I was single in my 40s.
Listen to my sage advice on being kind to retail workers. Just smile, walk away. You don't have a right to be an asshole. And enjoy Tommy celebrating the unrelenting wheel of time.
Time comes for all of us. You will all be out of touch with the culture. You'll all be asking someone what some equivalent of a Yassified means.
Terminally Online is a subscriber-exclusive show. To get access, subscribe to our Friends of the Pod community at cricket.com/friends.
Alex Ward is a writer for Politico and the author of the new book, The Internationalists, which chronicles the first 2 years of President Biden's foreign policy and administration. Alex, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tommy.
I need to first admit that you do an excellent national security newsletter for Politico. How often does it come out again? I read it every time, but...
Yeah, it's Wednesday through Friday, every, you know, 4 p.m. Eastern. So it's a big project that we do every day.
And nothing is more helpful for me in producing the show and the team here. So thank you for that. But let's talk about the book. So you finished this deep dive into President Biden's foreign policy in the first 2 years of the administration. Was there anything you learned reporting out the book that surprised you or was different from, you know, things you'd taken away from just sort of day-to-day reporting those first couple of years? And at the risk of asking a question that used to drive me insane when I was a spokesperson in government, did you come away feeling like there was a Biden doctrine when it comes to foreign policy?
I think what surprised me most is that there was a lot of Trumpism that was brought in to a Biden foreign policy, right? Because Biden, you know, 3 years old when World War II ended, he is an avatar for the traditional democratic foreign policy world, liberal international order, defense of democracy, that kind of thing. And Trump wins in 2016, and the team around him, mostly Jake Sullivan, the national security advisor, go, wait a minute. Trump did not necessarily win on his foreign policy views, but he didn't lose on them either. That there is clearly something in that thinking and in the stuff that he was promoting that the traditional foreign policy folks on the Democratic side and the Republican side had not internalized and not considered. And so thanks to Sullivan and others, Ben, we should note, in his work.
Ben Rose,
Ben Rose, work in National Security Action, helped develop this framework. And even though, especially Ben may not like my saying that a bit of Trumpism got in, let's say a bit of focus on the domestic front, a bit of populism got in and thinking about, okay, you can still defend democracy, you can still uphold the international order, but maybe it needs a reframing. Maybe it needs a bit of renewing in order to matter to people, which is why the moniker you constantly hear from Team Biden is a foreign policy for the middle class. Now, is that the doctrine? I don't think it is. I would say the doctrine is more along the lines of the absolute prioritization of defense of the liberal international order, of democracies and democracy at home and abroad, but with the twist of reframing it so it can last and not crack under the populist pressure that Trump and others have been putting on it.
I want to talk more about that, the fight for democracy and some of the, you know, those bigger picture themes here. But some of the chapters that really were like searing for me to read were about the Afghanistan withdrawal and those last few weeks and days and just how horrifying it was, most of all, obviously, for the people of Afghanistan. But also, this was clearly a scarring experience for the administration officials involved in Afghanistan policy or in the White House generally. How do you think that period of time and that outcome impacted Biden's decision-making going forward?
Quite significantly. I mean, look, we should note that Biden, in the moment of deciding to withdraw through now, stands by the decision, despite, you know, all the chaos around it and the fact that 13 service members were killed in the terrorist attack outside of Kabul's airport. But what I think happened is that Team Biden, more than Biden himself, were like, wait a minute, we got kind of flat-footed here. Yes, we made a decision, but look at how quickly the Taliban stormed to power. Look at how chaotic this withdrawal turned out to be. Look at how it's, you know, look at the optics of it. Even if you can still agree with the strategic decision overall, maybe tactically it led to some problems. So there was a sense within Team Biden to kind of go, okay, well, we need to prove ourselves again, and we need to internalize a lot of these things that we learned or rather unlearned from the Afghanistan situation and apply it to some future crisis. Unfortunately, in world politics, that's when Putin was basically starting to think about taking Ukraine. And so they, if there was a lick the wounds moment, it didn't last long because they had to quickly go, okay, well, what did we mess up in terms of like our processes and thinking? And how can we switch that quickly to apply it to, of course, a wholly different situation, which was Russia-Ukraine?
Yeah, I mean, on the decision itself, I mean, my view on Biden's decision to end the war is that it was the right one. And I also think that the responsibility for the outcome in some of the images we saw in you know, the horrifying images at the end, the responsibility for those lie with every administration. Bush, Obama, Trump, Biden. Trump in particular, like, cut the withdrawal deal, right? He all but shut down the processing of visas for Afghans who worked with the U.S. military, the SIV visas, which made it so hard to ramp that process back up at the end. So I get all that. And I'm like, I think, you know, Biden deserves some of the blame, but certainly not all of it. And I say that as someone with humility who worked on this policy. At the same time, you know, I did feel like in those final weeks, the administration's response to questions about the withdrawal were very defensive. They primarily focused on this being the largest, you know, airlift of people in history and not on the fact that it wasn't necessarily all the people we wanted to get out who are getting out, right? Like, a lot of like SIV visa holders were left behind. Did that kind of defensive crouch change over time as you revisited this in your reporting and went back to the same people like 6 months or a year later to talk about that time?
No. I mean, look, they gave me the kind of the spiel you did, which is, look, Alex, you can hold two thoughts in your head. This is the most impressive logistical, you know, moment, arguably, in modern, you know, military history, in terms of airlifting all these people out. What a coordinated feat this was, considering all the chaos that was surrounding Kabul and Afghanistan. And also, yes, we can recognize that there was humanitarian tragedy, but they would say, after 20 years of war, what did you expect? Like, did you expect this to go cleanly? And I think those are genuinely two fair arguments. What I would say, though, and what I try to write out in the book, is that there was a very important baked-in assumption in the decision to withdraw. And that was that it would take 18 to 24 months for the Taliban to take Kabul and effectively control all of Afghanistan. So because of that, I don't want to say the administration slow-walked moves on SIVs or getting folks out. And in fact, it's hard to say that because the military was like, if you're getting us out, speed is safety. We're moving.
Right.
You know, the White House was sort of taken aback by how quickly that military withdrawal took. But anyway, to the main point, 18 to 24 months was how much time they basically thought they had to produce as orderly an exit as possible. The fact that it crashed down on them so quickly, they had to improvise. They improvised, I think you can say, relatively well based on the airlift and all that. But there's no question that that improvisation and that forced upon them led to a chaotic withdrawal process where those who were actually in Kabul having to make decisions on like life or death decisions, quite literally, you know, had to do it on the fly, that you saw the death of the service members, and you saw just the general humanitarian devastation outside the airport. So was there going to be an orderly and good, quote unquote, withdrawal of Afghanistan? No. Did it have to be as bad? No, I don't think so either.
Yeah, I think if you gave President Biden truth serum and said, knowing what you know now, would you have pushed a withdrawal 4, 5, 6 months to get all the SIVs out? I'm sure he'd say yes. The very hard thing, I think, for you, for writing a book like this in the middle of a term, is that events change. And in this case, you know, you finished the book before the October 7th attacks and before things started to go pretty badly in Ukraine. Do those events and changes kind of make you rethink anything you wrote? Or how has that, you know, sort of impacted your view of the Biden foreign policy since?
Yeah, whenever the paper book comes out, I'm going to have to probably write a new epilogue.
Forward, yeah.
Forward or something, yeah. Look, I mean, I think it's true that when the time I finished writing the book, which was roughly the February of last year, things were looking really up, right? I mean, you had Ukraine was defended, these side issues that the Biden administration would put it, which at the time would have been the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, those were still quiet. I mean, just even before October 7th, you had Jake Sullivan say, you know, things are quiet in the Middle East. Like, that's how they were thinking about it. That's how they were feeling. And so there was a bit of optimism, like, okay, we got through this period. The West has stood up. Here we go. It hasn't gone as well. Of course, the counteroffensive shortly afterward did not work as planned. So, you know, Biden's sort of like campaign rally for NATO in Eastern Europe, you know, sort of did not go as hoped in Warsaw and, of course, later in NATO in Lithuania. And then, you know, Israel Hamas pops up and you have one of the core assumptions of Bidenism or a Biden doctrine, which was we can put these not unimportant, but in terms of the main things they care about, side issues, we can keep them quiet throughout so we can focus on the core things. That assumption proved relatively untrue, of course, because now it's dominating the entire agenda and threatening, you know, to destabilize quite a bit. Now, you hear Team Biden now say, well, we've always cared about the Israeli-Palestinian issue. This was something that we were working on throughout, you know, as part of Abraham Accords, et cetera. I think you kind of have to call BS on that a bit. There's no question that they cared about it in the months leading up to October 7th as they were doing the Israeli-Saudi normalization deal, right? Part of that deal had to be not concessions, but some improvements for the Palestinian cause. But that, again, only a couple months before October 7th. For the majority of the time of this administration, this was a totally back burner issue.
Yeah, I mean, it just shows you can go into a presidency with a doctrine or an idea for what you want to do, but events are always going to happen and overtake those things. The book made me think a lot about my time in government because you really got into the details of what the NSC does. And when I was in government, there's so much focus on inputs, basically like things we're doing versus outcomes. What I mean by that is like, you total up the number of meetings you had on an issue or diplomatic touches with, you know, foreign counterparts about something, and you use those as evidence that we're on top of things, but not necessarily the outcomes themselves, right? For an example would be the Russian invasion of Ukraine. The Biden administration, they released intelligence. There were these like tiger team meetings to plan for what might happen. There's lots of coordination among allies. All of that made it a lot easier to respond quickly once the invasion happened, but it didn't prevent it. How do you think you judge like the efficacy of an administration when you're looking at the inputs versus the outcomes, while also knowing that obviously like the U.S. can't control all events around the world? We don't get to tell Vladimir Putin what to do, for example.
Yeah, one of the quotes that I most remember in doing this book, and I should have it committed to memory, but paraphrasing was effectively this, which was, we did this about as perfectly as we could do it, and we still failed.
I remember that, yeah.
So, and I'm when, you know, the person I talked to told me that, I was like, man, that must just suck. Like, you did about as, I would give the administration credit. I think they did about as well as any administration could do in an attempt to prevent something like this. They were even open to diplomatic negotiations with Putin over some sacred cows, including NATO enlargement or Ukraine's position in moving further westward. There were genuine conversations and tough conversations with European allies, with Zelensky himself, who we must remember was pretty brutal with the U.S. and critical for saying, you guys are out of control. This is not going to happen. You don't know the Russians like we do. So when you consider the fact that the administration helped effectively warn the world that this was happening, warn Ukraine that this was happening, set up a sanctions regime, convince some skeptical Europeans to go pretty hard on Europe, that they were willing to talk with Russia and make some sort of deal, but basically be caught trying because no one expected Putin to actually make a move. But regardless, they got everything in train. They got everything prepared. They got the intelligence. They warned the world. They changed an intelligence practice to declassify information and explain what was going on. I mean, it was a pretty good response that unfortunately did not lead to its intended goal. Now, there are the critics who would say, well, the big mistake Team Biden did was not sanction Russia early or send weapons early. That would have been a deterrent. Of course, the Biden administration's plan was, well, that if you do the thing, then you're no longer deterring. Then Russia's already punished and they're going to do it anyway. We can't change the past. We don't know if that would have worked. But I think outside of that, knowing what we know, I've talked to no one really that thinks that it was a bad response. It's just if Putin's going to do it, Putin's going to do it.
Yeah, I find it very hard to believe that like some sanctions or sending 1,000 Javelin missiles in advance of the invasion would have deterred Putin when he wanted to take Ukraine. It was interesting remembering how challenging the U.S.-Ukraine relation was, particularly, you know, relations between Zelensky and Biden in advance of the invasion, how much the administration was trying to convince Zelensky that his country was about to be invaded. And he just wouldn't believe them. Either he genuinely didn't believe them, or he just didn't want to believe them. I can't really tell. I don't know if you know, but you know, that sort of period of the relationship feels like it's kind of been forgotten at this point.
Yeah, I mean, if there's anything sort of scoopy or newsy in the book, I mean, I think there's a lot of bits, but one of the sort of bigger thematic ones is we all knew that the U.S.-Ukraine relationship was tense. I don't think we knew it was this bad, and that's what the book tries to chronicle. I mean, Biden and Zelensky were in yelling matches at some points. I mean, it was really, really bad, and there was a moment where Biden was basically telling Zelensky, like, defend your city, defend your country, mobilize, what are you doing? And I think what I've... You know, I was not able to talk to many Ukrainians for this book. That's one of my regrets. But what the folks I did talk to and those who are close to the Ukrainians, they were, it's not that there was necessarily a political ploy. There was, of course, a political element to not saying we're about to get invaded because it's bad for the economy and all that. But there really was a sense that you Americans, your intelligence about war is constantly wrong. You know, we know the Russians better than you do, and they wouldn't do this. They've already invaded us. They're not going to go all out. That would be stupid. And so for Biden and, of course, other officials to come out and say, here's intelligence, here's what the Russians are planning, you know, we're warning the world, Ukraine, be careful, you know, Putin, be careful. Zelensky's like, stop doing that. Stop doing it. And it was rancorous. And I should say, nothing sharpens the mind more than an invasion, because the moment Russia got in, Zelensky was like, all right, send me weapons, send me money. Like, what can we do? This is happening. And so, you know, he, of course, his tune changed and he's led a phenomenal defense of his nation. But in the walk up, he was about as skeptical as anybody that it was going to happen.
Yeah, and I guess in his defense, I mean, you look at the intelligence around the Iraq war, you look at the intelligence around the Afghan withdrawal, it's understandable that he might question the products at that point. But, you know, that said, the intelligence was like 100,000 troops on the border, so it was a little more obvious that he was planning an invasion of some sort. Last question for you. When I was in government, there were lots of great people I worked with, well-meaning people who would like earnestly, but I think a little performatively say, you know, like politics has no place in the Situation Room, right? Which of course is like patently ridiculous. The only reason we all were allowed in that room is because Barack Obama was elected president. So politics is inextricably linked to everything you do, foreign policy including. I was wondering what the folks you talked to in the Biden administration, how they feel about how politics is impacting their ability to do the things they want to do these days, because you know, the book ends like America is ready for renewal. The world was there to remake. There are at least two more years to get it done. Early on, Republicans were playing ball on some of those renewal efforts. Now they are absolutely not, including, you know, aid for Ukraine, other things that were seen as bipartisan in the past. So I'm wondering how, like, you know, politics is now in the minds of someone like a Jake Sullivan who's trying to run the foreign policy apparatus.
Yeah, I can't say I spoke to them directly on this question, but I have an informed guess, which was, you know, in the first year or two, the assumption was if we connect politics to foreign policy, because again, implicit in foreign policy for the middle class is you are doing something for the American people, ergo, it will be popular. So there's no question there's a domestic political part here.
Yeah.
So right. I think they felt that in the first 2 years or so, if there was success in Ukraine, if, you know, we got Afghanistan and things were all right, if we righted the relationship with China, if we focused on climate change and that kind of thing, that eventually the people would go, our lives are better, America's in a better place, and then there would be, let's say, more popularity or more support for Biden foreign policy because it could be working. And one could argue that roughly around the time I stopped writing this book, they had that moment. They kind of were there. I mean, granted, politics are what they are. There will always be critics among Republicans. And I'm not saying it's a perfect foreign policy by any means. But I think that was the level of optimism that they felt and that I was picking up on it when I tried to write it. Now, I don't think anyone's there. And of course, at the moment that we're chatting, it looks like this, you know, border deal, Ukraine thing is done. Right. So we're now in the grind moment, the 2024 election moment. And what's fascinating to me is, you know, as Biden and likely Trump comes up, Biden was really planning to go on the strength of his foreign policy. And look what we did. Look how we saved America after what Trump did to us in the world. That's their thinking. And now it's not so clear he has that advantage. And now that debate is now turned into like visions of the world and what way America should go. And it's turned into who won't start World War III.
Yeah. I mean, I think unfortunately foreign policy has turned into a challenging position for Biden vis-a-vis Trump, because the things that, you know, actually break through in the press are events like the Afghanistan withdrawal, and people have a negative opinion of those. But I also think that there was an NBC poll the other day that talked about, you know, who is better, Trump or Biden, on improving America's standing in the world. And Trump was up 11 points, right? You know, that might just be like when your approval is underwater, your approval is underwater across a whole host of issues, but it doesn't make it feel like, you know, foreign policy is a real wind at their back at the moment, in particular with Gaza and what it's doing to the Democratic Party.
Yeah, if I recall, and I don't have polls in front of me, but if I recall that, you know, Biden had stronger numbers on that aspect in general, not necessarily against Trump, but just in general, you know, far before Israel, Hamas. So it's, you know, this is very much impacting him. And I should note, you know, Biden's numbers sunk pretty strongly around the Afghanistan withdrawal. So it's one of those things. There's a maxim in foreign policy that, you know, foreign policy can't make a presidency, but it can break one. Right. And in this case, you know, you could argue that Biden did a lot of great things. Is the liberal international order more secure? You could make that case. Is West more rallied together and united? You could make that case. Has climate change been prioritized as an issue? Slightly, but you can make that case. But when most people think of Biden's foreign policy, my guess is they go Afghanistan withdrawal and Israel Hamas, and those aren't good stories to tell.
Yeah. The good news is there's some time to fix that and to right the ship there. But yeah, at the moment, I think it's a bit of a nadir. But Alex, thank you so much for talking with me. The book is The Internationalists. Everyone should go pick it up now. It's coming out, what, a couple days?
About February 20th, yeah.
Excellent. Well, everyone should check it out and check out, you know, all the writing you're doing over Politico, because you guys do great work. And thanks for helping us produce the show.
Thanks for having me, Tommy. I'll look forward to my residual checks.
Yeah, here you go. I want my cut. Just kidding. Thanks again to Alex Ward for joining the show. And that's all I got.
Thanks to Liz Truss.
Thanks to Liz and Rishi. Rishi Sunak's always hanging out in Santa Monica, so I'm surprised we haven't seen him.
I'm going to miss Rishi Sunak when he's defeated, because he's actually turned out to be good content.
He will probably end up living out here, and he will probably at some point through an intermediary ask you for a meeting.
And his life will be really good, you know? The thing about Rishi is that, you know, he'll be rich guy. Like, he's a smart guy. Like, he'll probably get into, like, tech or something and make gobs of money. And
tons of cash.
Yeah, yeah. He'll probably be on this podcast, actually.
He'll be a VC.
We had David Cameron on the podcast.
Yeah.
We should come on.
Who kind of is on the world stage now looking like the prime minister, and it's got to piss Sunak off. He floated that they were going to recognize
Palestinian state
at the UN, and then he'd walk it back.
Yeah, the Cameron Declaration.
Tough. Like the Balfour. Okay, that's enough for us. Talk to you next week. If you want to get ad-free episodes, exclusive content, and more, consider joining our Friends of the Pod subscription community at crooked.com/friends. Don't forget to follow Crooked Media on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter for more original content, host takeovers, and other community events. Plus, find Pod Save the World on YouTube for access to full episodes, bonus content, and more. And if you're as opinionated as us, consider dropping a review. Pod Save the World is a Crooked Media production. Our executive producers are me, Tommy Vitor, Ben Rhodes, and Reed Cherlin. Our producer is Ilona Minkowski, and associate producer is Ashley Mizuo. It's mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Audio support by Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Our studio technician is David Tolles. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn and Phoebe Bradford, who upload our episodes and videos to youtube.com/podsavetheworld. On Chasing Life, CNN's chief medical correspondent, Dr. Sanjay Gupta, helps you create meaningful change in your life and gives you the real strategies to optimize your health. This season, Chasing Life is taking on the topic of weight loss. New episodes of Chasing Life come out every Tuesday. Listen to Chasing Life with Dr. Sanjay Gupta from CNN Audio, wherever you get your podcasts.